Kim versus Sidman will hear that case. We're ready when you are, counsel.
May it please the court, Leo Finkelstein. May it please the court, Leo Finkelstein from Colorado Springs, number 18455, on behalf of the appellant guardians, Mike and Renee Sidman. We're here before the court today to discuss a case that may have far-reaching implications in the area of guardianships. Mike and Renee Sidman, as guardians of their nephew, since he was 19 months old, applied to the district court for a child support order imposed upon the parents. The parents have a combined gross income, monthly income, of $12,585 per month. Mr. West is here today, argued before the district court that the parents were not, that the court was not obligated to use the child support guidelines, but if they did use the child support guidelines set forth in the Title 14, that they use the guardian's income on one set of the guidelines and the parent's income on the other. I proposed to the court that that was clear error. When there are two orders that were involved in the child support matters. The first is not at issue in this case. It was issued by Judge Steve Pelican on June 11, 2008. He simply ruled that at the support hearing, the court will follow the standards set out in CRS 14-10-115. To determine support. He further ruled that the guardians, that statutes pertaining to guardianship as cited by the guardians allowed them to apply for child support. He did not say how he intended to use 1410.115. That was left up to the judge that heard the hearing, and it turned out to be Judge Kennedy. In his order, Judge Kennedy says, I'm quoting from the order, pursuant to 1410.115, the court is required to consider the income of each side of this case. I posit to this court that that's plainly wrong. It's inconsistent with this court's prior ruling in Conradson, which I've cited in my brief, in which the court held that it was irrelevant and improper to take into account an aunt's, a custodial aunt's, or resources in determining the child support owed by parents, and it's inconsistent with the statutory framework. It's inconsistent both with the statutory guardianship framework and the statutory child support framework. It's inconsistent with the guardianship framework in 1514.209 sub 2, quote, a guardian need not use the guardian's personal funds for the ward's expenses. When you put on one side of a child support worksheet a guardian's income, it reduces the amount of support owed by the parents. And the way that worked in this case, if one were to look at the schedule of basic child support obligations, I'm going to quote the statute. The basic child support obligation shall be determined using the schedule of basic child support obligations contained in paragraph B of subsection 7. This is in 1410.115. The basic child support obligation shall be divided between the parents in proportion to their adjusted gross incomes. Nowhere in the statutory framework does it impose a duty on the guardians, or to say that the guardian's income should be included. And based upon the parent's income, their obligation of support is $1,381 per month. And it's in the actual table set forth in 1410.115. When the court put the guardian's income on one side and the parents on the other, it reduced that parent's support by over $1,000 a month, because these guardians have means to support this child. They have money. These are not poor people. Neither side are poor people. But I posit to you it's an error of law. You have de novo review. It's an error of law for the court to have done that.
Mr. Finkelstein, can you address the effect of 1514.207.1? That's the statute that I think your opponent relies primarily on, and it says except as otherwise limited by the court, a guardian of a minor ward has the duties and responsibilities of a parent regarding the ward's support, care, education, health, and welfare.
I can address that. The, when they talk about what the guardian shall do, they shall become and remain personally acquainted with the ward, maintain sufficient contact with the ward, take reasonable care of the ward's personal effects, expend money of the ward, is what the statute says, which has been received by the guardian for the ward's current needs for support, care, education, health, and welfare. It does not, I posit that there's a quite a substantial difference between applying to be a guardian and going to court and applying for allocation of parental responsibilities. We have two different statutory frameworks, and they are quite different. There's differences in the standards by which review will be posited in the future. Guardians have to report to the court every year, annually. They can be removed from the court. The court maintains a continuing supervision, whereas in an APR-type case, if they were allocated parental responsibilities, if they had applied for that, that's permanent. It deprives the parents of all permanent, of all parental responsibilities. The parents would have to come back to the court and show that there is endangerment to the child if they wanted to get their parental responsibilities back. They don't have to do that in a guardianship action. They'd have to show just best interests. There are numerous differences, and I simply think that it'd be erroneous to take that and equate that with a child support obligation that therefore their income is used in determining the parents' duty of support, which is really what's happened here.
Well, wait a minute, Mr. Finkelstein, let me direct your attention to 1514, 209, paren 2, mm-hmm. which states, a guardian need not use the guardian's personal funds for the ward's expenses.
Yes.
Isn't that tie, now, does that contradict 207, or does that emphasize the difference?
I think it emphasizes it. I wouldn't find, I know the council has said that they're contradictory. To me, they're not. The guardian has a duty of support to make sure the child is supported. That doesn't mean that they have to use their personal funds. They may use it.
Let me take the question one step further.
Mm-hmm.
That particular section, I think, was discussed by the Colorado Supreme Court in the case which was decided about 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
That's in Ray JCT. And in that case, the court said that a guardian is responsible for the ward's physical well-being, including the provision of shelter, food, clothing, medical care, or other necessities of life. Further, that a guardian has essentially the same authority and responsibilities with regard to the child as a parent. And then with the, there's an exception, the last sentence, part of that sentence, with the exceptions that the guardian typically does not provide the financial resources to support the child and serve solely at the pleasure of the appointing court. Now tell me, why are we not bound by the decision of the Colorado Supreme Court in JCT?
Well, you're bound by this decision of the Colorado Supreme Court in JCT, but the Colorado Supreme Court in JCT didn't tell you how to interpret the Colorado Child Support Guidelines.
That they did, but are we bound by the decision of the phrase at the end, with the exception that the guardian typically does not provide the financial resources to support the child and serve solely at the pleasure of the appointing court? And I'm going to ask the court of counsel.
Mm-hmm.
For the
I think what the Supreme Court did in that case, Your Honor, is that's basically a recitation of Hornbook probate law. I mean, you can look it up. Guardians are generally not responsible to use their own money for the support of a ward. They can apply to the courts for any recourse that may be available. They can get any state funding that might be available. There may be disability payments. They can ask for child support, as was done in this case. Any monies that would be due a parent on behalf of a child, they can have reallocated to themselves. A typical example would be Social Security disability payments for a child, or for the parent or the child's portion when a parent is disabled. So they have the recourse to try to coalesce and obtain all available resources for the child. And I posit that includes the right to apply for child support from the parents, who have a duty to support the child under the McQuaid and Abrams decisions. There's a long line of decisions of the Supreme Court that posit in all kinds of situations where the parents are not caring for their child, their duty of support survives. And it inures to the...
Mr. Finkelstein, you neatly avoided answering my question. But you've done it very...
I think that...
What are we bound by in JCT or not?
The last sentence in JCT, if that's what you're meaning, is dictum. The court didn't actually analyze the financial situations of those parties, as near as I can recall. So I would say that you're not bound by that. It's typically that the guardians don't have to pay. I would argue that that is, in fact, a correct statement of the law. But I don't think JCT actually addressed this kind of situation that's before you today. And the reason it's important is it has other ramifications. When you include the guardian's income on one side of a ledger, of the child support ledger, other things follow. One of the arguments that I've made is that on transportation expenses, what happens is when the parents want to visit the child, and the court found that the average cost is $500 per month, that goes in as a deduction on their side of the child support worksheet, pursuant to the Colorado Child Support Guidelines. When you do that, it's effectively transferring 61% of that cost onto the guardians. It's reducing the parents' support obligation because it's being allocated to the parties, in this case guardians versus parents, in proportion to their income. So suddenly the guardians are subsidizing the parents' visits to their children by 61%. Another example, there is a third, this is the second appeal of this case. The first appeal was on the issue of the termination of the guardianship. There's a third appeal before this court as we sit here right now. Judge Sells, who's inherited this case, has ruled that the guardians now must pay 61% of the child's medical expenses because he's bound by the law of the case, which found that the guardian's income is included in the child support worksheets. And so we've appealed that as well, and that'll be coming up the latter shortly. It has significant ramifications, and I simply posit to you, it's a clear error of law. It's inconsistent with JCT, although I think that portion of JCT was dicta. And it's inconsistent with Conradson, clearly. And it's inconsistent with the other cases I've cited, both Bonifaz, which the court found there was no statutory duty of support to the non-parent. It was a contractual duty. And it's inconsistent with Roderick, which made the distinction between guardianships and allocation of parental responsibility cases. I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Daniel West. My bar number is 27573, and I'll try to speak up as loud as I can. I was at the Bronco game on Sunday, and I think I lost my voice a little bit. But I represent the plaintiff's appealees here, who I refer to as parents today. And I'll refer to the defendant appellants as the guardians. The only facts I think are relevant here is that the guardians obtained permanent guardianship with absolutely no restrictions. They have since successfully defended efforts by the parents to terminate that guardianship, despite the fact that parents have been determined to be able and willing to care for the child. There's no question my clients have a duty of support under Abrams and McQuaid, as counsel stated. That's not the question. The question is, do they have the duty of support or do they have a duty of support? Do they have the duty of support as opposed to a duty of support? And what I mean by that is, do the guardians also have a duty of support? And I would state that they do, and then we have to answer the question, is that defined under 1410.115? Because I believe that it does, that the trial court should be affirmed. Now, admittedly, 1410.115 only talks about a parent's duty of support. However, 1410.115.1c specifically says that child support provisions under the statute, quote, shall apply to all child support obligations established or modified as a part of any proceeding. And it's that specific case that the Roderick Court, this court, a division of this court, said you can order a non-parent to pay support, or that a non-parent can have a support obligation. And I think,
what do you do, though, with the statute that specifically states that it's 1514 2092, quote, "A guardian need not use the guardian's personal funds for the ward's expenses." Isn't that dispositive?
I don't think it is, because I think it specifically, it conflicts with 1514207, which says unless the court otherwise limits it, the guardian has the duties of a parent. And I've suggested how I believe you can harmonize those two sections, and I think it's a reasonable way to do it. I also think that you have to look past even the probate code. And I want to talk a lot about Roderick today, because I think it's real important. Roderick talks about the definition of legal custody under 19.1.103. And what Roderick says is, hey, these people are legal custodians under that definition, and a legal custodian, the conclusion is a legal custodian has a support obligation. And Roderick is important because the guardians rely heavily on Conradson. Well, Conradson was an informal arrangement. This is not an informal arrangement. They applied to the El Paso County District Court for guardianship and received it.
Let's take a look at Roderick. And I read Roderick. First of all, unlike the parental responsibility order issued in Roderick, there's no such order in this case. Is that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Let me go on.
Okay.
In Roderick, the division specifically distinguished the parental responsibility order from a guardianship, and which is what we have in this case, a guardianship, by stating the parental responsibility order was not a guardianship order and did not create a ward-guardian relationship. Rather, the parental responsibility order was a prelude to adoption, and as such, it had legal significance established by the statute. My reading of Roderick does not support your argument because of these distinguishing factors. Take it off from there, Mr. West.
Thank you, Your Honor, and certainly, I think I tried to address that in my brief, but I'll answer because I think that's a very important issue. When the Roderick case said that, that wasn't the decision. That wasn't the issue before the court. They distinguished it. They said, the non-parent in that case said, hey, I'm a guardian, so 1514207, or excuse me, 1514209-2 applies to me. All the Court of Appeals said there is, you're not a guardian, and therefore that statute doesn't apply. So I don't think it's the law of the case. I don't think it's dictum. I think it's dictum. I also think that Roderick is based on, does the party have legal custody under 19.1.103? And I cited in my brief 19.1.103.60, subparagraph 60, for the fact that absolutely these guardians in this particular case have legal custody. And as having legal custody, they have a support obligation under the holding of Roderick. I absolutely agree that Roderick is different because it applies to a parental responsibilities case. But the underlying decision is based on the definition of legal custody under
19.1.103. Where is it established in this case that Michael Sidman and his wife have custody of this child, Diaz?
Okay.
Where?
Because under 19.1.103.60, it provides that guardians with rights and responsibilities of custody where legal custody has not...
That assumes custody with rights and responsibilities of custody. Was there a custody order in this case?
Absolutely not, but the definition under 19.1.103.60 includes legal custodians as guardians depending on the facts of the case, and they meet that definition because no other individual has been granted legal custody. So under the statute, they meet that definition as people with legal custody.
Well, are you suggesting then that a person who's appointed guardian for a child or whoever has custody of that child?
They have legal custody under 19.1.103.60 so long as nobody else has been appointed the legal custodian.
Long as no one else has been appointed.
That's correct.
The mere fact of being accepting the position of guardian by appointment by the proper appropriate court, that in itself establishes a custody.
I believe so long as nobody else has been appointed custody under that plain language of 19.1.103. I also cite Clark versus Kendrick that stands for the proposition that a guardian is generally entitled to legal custody of a minor. I think the problem you're getting to, and I think it's absolutely correct, is that, gee, should we hold the policy issue is, should we hold guardians, you know, to this, to having a duty of support? Well, we hold people that have parental responsibilities to that, and under PD case, they can get rid of it at any time they want to.
Well, what about JT? I asked Mr. Finkelstein, now I'm going to ask you the application of JT to this case.
And I think I actually agree with counsel that, well, first of all, of course you have to follow Supreme Court precedent. I don't certainly wouldn't argue with you on that. I do not, I think it's dicta as well, though, that last sentence, because it says typically. That doesn't mean always. And so I don't think, and that wasn't the issue before the Supreme Court. It's in, it was dicta.
Well, as I remember, that was an Indian child, wasn't it? And JT?
Judge, your recollection of the facts of that case are better than mine. I do not recall.
Mr. West, can I ask you a question on your reliance on 1514-207?
Yes.
And perhaps 19-1103 as well, although I can't claim familiarity with that statute. But 207 states, except as otherwise limited by a court, a guardian of a minor ward has the duties and responsibilities of a parent regarding the ward's support. My question to you, though, is whether that is not more directed towards the obligation that the guardian has to the ward only, as opposed to the obligation that the guardian has to the parents, if any.
I think I understand your question. I'm not sure. I think it's a distinction without a difference. In this case, the guardians have they have the child primarily in their care. So my clients have to pay support. Whether you're paying support or not, they still have a duty of support. And so I don't think it undermines the parents. I think that they both, my argument here is they both have a duty of support. And because they both have a duty of support, we have to include the parents or the guardian's income in the child support worksheet, just as the court of the trial court did here. Does that answer your question?
Well, yes and no. I think what's concerning me is that the statutory language appears somewhat loose and supports both sides' interpretation.
And I think because it's that way, you have to try to harmonize them under basic statutory interpretation. And I think I've posited a way to do that that makes sense to me. And that the way to put these statutes together so they work is if the trial court says, I'm appointing you guardian, but I'm specifically saying under 1514-207 that you do not have to support this child and we're going to enter a child support order. If that were the case, then I think that that would be the limiting that's required by 1514-2092. I think I just meant it just the other way around, 1514-2092. And that's what I think. And 1514-2092 is not mandatory. It says they need not. It doesn't say they shall not or anything like that. And I think you really, I certainly was not familiar with 19-1103 until I read the Roderick case in detail, but the Roderick case is very clear. It comes down to the legal custody issue.
Well, let's follow up on that legal custody issue.
Certainly.
In the case of in marriage of Conradson, which another division of this court heard in 1979, the court, in effect, in considering 1410-115, concluded that the factors to be considered in making a support award do not include the financial resources of a non-parent with whom the child is living. And so what we have here is a non-parent, the child is living with this Alan Sidman and his wife.
Mike and Renee Sidman.
The child is living, isn't the child living with Alan Sidman?
No, Alan Sidman is my client, the parent. The child is living with the guardians.
Michael, yes, okay, excuse me. And is living with the Mike, and who's a non-parent, and the court said in that case, which is 30 years old, that the factors to be considered making a support award do not include the financial resources of a non-parent.
And I would say that you
a non-parent, and the question is, does what you're suggesting is, I think, help me if I'm wrong, that because of custody, in effect, they're like the parents.
I think Conradson is still good law, but you got to read the facts in Conradson very closely. And the facts in Conradson is the aunt didn't have any type of formal arrangement with the child. She simply took her niece into her home.
Yes.
That is contrasted with this case, first of all, and it's contrasted with the more recent case of Roderick, which is just an OA case. There, a non-parent had a duty of support because they had legal custody of the child. So I think Conradson is not the same as this case. I think the Roderick case is more consistent with that case.
So that, again, spins back to the question, who has legal custody? Does Michael Sidman have legal custody of this boy?
How can Alan and Cheryl Sidman have legal custody of the child that they have no decision-making responsibility over?
So what we have to determine is that Michael, the uncle, and aunt have legal custody.
I agree with that statement. That is exactly
correct.
That's my position.
Okay.
And I would, just to follow up, I cannot see how my clients have legal custody. Because of the guardianship, they have no decision-making responsibility. They have limited parenting time with the child. How can they have legal custody as opposed to the people who are making decisions?
But there's no order of custody in this case.
Well, I don't think you're using the word custody that doesn't exist in Title 14 anymore. It's allocation of parental responsibilities. Custody is listed in the Children's Code and it is defined, and it includes guardianship under 19.1.103.60 under the facts of this case.
All right.
And that's what I think is significant.
Thank you.
I'll briefly address the last two issues, which is the capital gains income. I believe that the guardians failed to preserve that issue on appeal. They certainly argued that their income should not have been included, but that's very different from the issue of should the trial court have deviated from the child support guidelines. There was never once a mention of deviating from the guidelines. The argument was we shouldn't use their income. So now they're arguing for the first time on appeal that the capital gains income shouldn't have been included. Frankly, the capital gains are income under the child support guidelines. So if you find that the child support guidelines are applicable here, as we assert, then the capital gains certainly should have been included. And if you don't have any other questions,
what about the visitation issue? That's the unstated issue so far. The visitation issue.
Yes, Your Honor.
What about that?
Having to pay for the transportation?
The guardians are being required to take the child to Massachusetts, pay their airfare, and all that business.
To me, it's the exact same issue as whether they have a support obligation or not, because under 14.10.115, they have to pay a percentage of the travel expense, which is all the court ordered them to do. The court didn't order them to pay more.
No.
And so if 14.10.115 is applicable, as we argued before the trial court and as the trial court agreed to, then 14.10.115 specifically talks about...
Well, what about the offer by, I think it was in the record somewhere, that the guardians agreed that a certain amount of that money could be reduced for child support.
As I understand that argument, to me, if you agree that it should be in the child support calculation, you agree that you have an obligation to support it, because the child support worksheet splits that up. It splits it up between the two sides.
Yeah.
So they conceded the fact that, yes, they should get credit for that. By conceding that they should get credit for it, they said that they should be responsible for a portion of the cost, because it reduces the child support accordingly.
Mr. West, your time has expired. Thank you very much for your argument.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court, I'll go to that last point. With respect to the transportation expenses, there was no such concession. When the expenses are allocated against the father, for example, Alan Sidman in this case, it presumes, to say that there was a concession, that would be presuming that the guardians had agreed to put their income into the formula in the first place. Then there's a shifting. But if their income isn't in the child support worksheet, there's no shifting. It makes no difference, not $1 difference, whether you include the parents' $500 for transportation in that worksheet, if the guardian's income is not in the worksheet. There's no shifting of expenses. So I think it's not appropriate to say that they conceded to that issue. The attorney that represented them at the hearing said, yes, you can include it in the worksheet, but don't include their income. And when you don't include their income, there's no shifting of that expense to the guardians. With respect to another matter, the JCT case is a very interesting case, Judge Rivera. It's very interesting because it held, for the first time to my knowledge, it actually accepted a practice that's used in Colorado Springs rarely but occasionally, where the court defines themselves as the child's guardian because they can't find anybody. We had a magistrate that did that for years. The current magistrate does it rarely. But the court takes on the guardianship responsibility until someone can be found. Sometimes that can extend for years. And if the court's going to take on the guardianship responsibility and determine where the child lives and goes to school and medical care and so on, does that mean that the state's resources are going to be counted as a way to reduce whatever the non-custodial parents' obligation is? Because if you hold that guardians' incomes are going to be included on one side of the ledger, consider just who guardians are in some cases. There are agencies that are guardians. There's human services that are guardians. There's the guardianship court themselves on occasion.
Just a minute, Mr. Finkelstein. Your opponent has response to my questions. Said in effect that the aunt and uncle, in this case, are the legal custodians, and therefore they have an obligation. What's your position on that? Are they legal custodians?
I would argue no. They have the responsibilities that legal custodians would have, but to be legal custodians, they need to go and apply for allocation of parental responsibilities, get a permanent custody order that's going to deprive the parents of a number of residual responsibilities. And we have two different statutory frameworks. It's very different than Roderick, where those non-parents went and applied for parental responsibilities. I see that my time is up, and I thank the court.
Thank you both for your arguments this afternoon. The case will stand submitted. We'll get your written opinion in due course.